This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius. Live. Fit. Go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need. From athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist. Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
I harvested 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Welcome back to another Western Rookie Podcast brought to you by Go Hunt. Today, I'm really excited because I've got Danielle Pruitt on the podcast, and we're going to be talking about some really exciting news that you've got going on, Danielle.
Hi.
Well, you've got a lot of exciting news in your life right now,
yeah,
but the topic of today is going to be your new book.
Yes, I am so excited. Thank you for having me on. I have my first cookbook coming out October 8th, and so it's predominantly wild game based, although there's some other things involved in the cookbook that's pretty exciting, because that's what I do. I travel and hunt around the U.S. because I think I have the coolest job in the world. I work for a company called Meat Eater and as a culinary contributor. And so, this book was a huge labor of love. Spent many years just diving into the outdoors and getting to really try a diversity of ingredients to cook with, and which is my biggest passion. So yeah, the book is something that's really special to me.
Yes. And so it's called Wild and Whole, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it will be, so this podcast actually is going to be great timing because it's going to come out on your launch day. So if you're listening to this today, the book is available.
Today's the day.
Where can people find it?
anywhere books are sold. So you can get it from our website at themeateater.com. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes and Nobles. Some small local bookstores will carry it. I don't know which ones, depending on where you live. But most places where books are sold, you can get it.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say the Meat Eater website would be maybe the best place if folks are looking to actually, you know, get it and support the team and you and Meat Eater all at once and maybe get some cool Meat Eater gear while you're at it?
Yeah, you know, the best place to buy it, I'm learning the pub business. This is new for me. It's interesting the way this works. Ironically, Amazon is not the best place to buy things. Right. It's always independent stores, independent bookstores. So like in Montana, where Meat Eater's based, there's some small bookstores in the downtown that'll have it. There's an actual Meat Eater store downtown that'll have it. Those local places are always the best. And then behind that, the Meat Eater store is a great place to go. They like to see diversity of where people are buying. Because if you buy everything, if everybody buys it all at Amazon, I don't really understand why. This is not my line of work. I don't understand why, but I just know, having it from different sources is the best. As far as like ratings and reviews go from a publishing standpoint.
Very cool. Yeah, and I just saw some of the new Meat Eater store content that they're putting out. Super cool. Wish I was closer to Bozeman so I could go more often. But yeah, next time I'm in. My wife actually just said, hey, we should take a trip to Bozeman. I think we'd like it. I'm like, yeah, I think I would love it. I've just driven through on elk hunts before. Never really stopped except for a pizza.
It's changed quite a bit over the years. It's a different town, but it's still like a really cool place to visit.
Yeah.
Especially if you like skiing or fly fishing or anything.
Anything outside. I mean, I feel like Bozeman's one of those towns where like it's just outdoors central. Like mountain biking, hiking, skiing, snowboarding, hunting, fishing, bird watching, wildlife, photography, camping. I mean, all of them are just boom, you can do it all right there in that one town.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to live in North Dakota, and I mean, we had all the hunting we could want at our fingertips, but we would go into Montana just to
see a hill,
ski, and I liked cross-country skiing because I could take – I have two bird dogs, so I could take my dogs with me cross-country skiing and have some hills because North Dakota's pretty flat.
Yeah, I feel that. I used to live in Fargo, so.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
The flattest part of North Dakota.
Yeah, that is the flattest. We were at least on the western half.
Cool. So one of the things I've been curious about since we've been lining up this podcast, it's a combination, obviously, of writing and cooking. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious, when you were, you know, kind of navigating your career at Meat Eater or, you know, even before that, did you start with a passion for one or the other, or did you have both? Because, I mean, they're very, you know, different lanes you could be in. Like, some people are just like, I just am a cook. Like, I'm a professional chef, and that's just what I do. And other people are obviously, like, I just write books and I write articles. Mm-hmm. But to bring both together, I feel like it's almost like you have to have a passion for both. So I was just kind of curious how that went for you.
Well, I will not say I have a passion for writing. That was a learned skill that was painful for me to undertake. Wild and Whole was a brand I started, I want to say about 8 years ago now. And it was really sort of part of this experiment, I want to say, that I was doing. It was a blog, and I didn't want to tell anybody I was writing this blog because I thought blogs were cheesy. But I really was sort of undergoing this sort of new lifestyle where my husband and I had decided that we were going to hunt for all of our own protein. And we ended up doing that for a very long time, for like 10 years. And I just needed a resource and a creative outlet to be able to talk about it and photograph it and just sort of have my own personal recipe thing. Fortunately, it did not stay a secret. And then it kind of word got out and just sort of took off very unexpectedly. But it was definitely all geared around the food and the cooking primarily, and the writing was something I had to really learn how to hone that skill.
Yeah. So the passion really originated with the food and the cooking and the experience of gathering food. And I'm guessing from the name, whole food, like good, healthy food, you know, seeing the ingredients from start to finish more so than, you know, obviously the world we live in where a majority of our food is highly processed and, you know, there's not a lot of visibility to where where the food came from. Right. I would assume. Yeah. So very cool. I feel like my wife and I are also on a beginning phases of that same journey. Obviously we've been hunting for a long time, but now we just bought a farmstead. And so we're getting really big into gardening. We've kind of got a his and hers garden because she wanted to plant different things than I did. And so she took over the garden space that the house came with, which is like 1,000 square foot garden. And then I had to go find my own area to plant. I wanted to plant like all berries and fruit. So
cool.
We're doing the berries, the fruit. We have chickens now. So we're hopefully going to be getting eggs soon, farm fresh eggs. She's got a lot of vegetables. We're going to be planting some orchards next spring. So yeah, we're really diving into the whole, you know, we've already had the wild half. Now we're really diving into the rest of it and having the whole.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so that kind of concept came because I approached food from a very holistic, well-rounded standpoint where wild game was so important to me because, you know, it's the protein and it's my way of connecting to the outdoors. But what about all the other things on your plate? Like, what about everything else? You know, I came from this wanting to eat consciously and sustainably. And I thought, well, I mean, I thought I spend so much time thinking about that with protein. Why do I not think about that with everything else, from not just vegetables, but like the flour I'm buying, the oils I'm buying, all of those things. And so that's kind of where that name comes from, is sort of, is sort of leaning into that. And everything I do with recipes is very whole food driven, which is not to say that it's a health book by any means. Some of the recipes are quite indulgent, but it's real food, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah. I don't know if it's good or bad, but I always feel better about myself if I indulge on a food that has like good clean ingredients.
Yeah.
Versus like indulging on something, you know, fast foodish, you know, in that lane.
Oh, it's easily.
Like, well, at least this was like good food. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with cheese. Like, cheese comes from very good sources. Like, and I really like cheese. So, like, I feel better when I have, like, a really heavy pasta dish with, like, like hand-shredded cheese with no preservatives and stuff like that compared to, like, you know, the alternative. And I'm like, I don't know if this is good or not, but it helps me sleep better at night because I at least saw all the process and we made it from scratch and
it
we
didn't
made it
come from the macaroni box.
Right, exactly.
With food dyes and all the other preservatives.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not an expert. I'm an electrical engineer. And so I am by no means a nutritionist or anything in healthcare. My wife is a pharmacist, so she's way better than all that than I am. But I am a little like starting to become more concerned with the amount of things that I can't pronounce in boxes of food.
Mm-hmm.
Like growing up, I was like, I don't know. It tastes good. It's cheap. You know, whatever. You know, when I was in my early 20s in college, maybe because that was the most pressing concern was the budget. But now I'm like, I don't know if I want to eat this because look at all the things on here. I don't know what this is. And so now we're, you know, I guess one way of doing that, we're just making like our own sourdough. We got a sourdough starter. And we've been doing that the last couple months. And so when you said like where your flour comes from, we had that conversation. Are we going to do, you know, are we going for the organic flour or not? And I'm like, I don't know. I feel like that might be worth it.
Flour,
but then it's hard to find.
Man, bread baking, flour is a big choice. The protein percentage is a big deal with how it turns. I'm a terrible at baking bread. I've tried and I still suck at it. Yeah, that's fun. That's a cool journey that you're going on, and it's extremely rewarding as well.
It to me, and we had, I'm sure you're familiar with Weston Paul and Mountain Tough because they're right there in your backyard, but we had Weston Paul on the podcast a while ago, and we kind of made the correlation. It's almost like it's the same, like that same inner drive that makes us feel so appreciative and engaged with bringing meat home because we went out and did it, mm-hmm. but you just apply it to like vegetables in your garden.
You know, that's a, you know,
like
funny.
I grew it and I did this and I brought this home versus I just went to the store and bought it.
So I talk about this a little bit. Have you ever heard of the-
Hey folks, application season is finally wrapped up and I hope each and every one of you has a tag for this fall. And by now you should be starting to think about your e-scouting plans. I'm working on mine as we speak for my Western hunts, and it's actually one of my favorite parts of the entire season, and that's because of Go Hunt Insider. Go Hunt has everything I need to plan an amazing experience this fall. I always start with filtering 2.0 to read up on what my unit has to offer, what the access is like, what the local buzz is. I look at the trophy potential and the harvest rates, and I take all of that information from filtering 2.0 and I move over to Go Hunt Maps, and that is where things get exciting. I'm finding glassing knobs with the 3D mapping features. I'm using the terrain analysis, something that's new you might not have seen yet, where I can look at slopes. I can see which slope is facing which directions, how steep it is, what the elevation is. It's a super cool feature, and it's helping me plan out my routes. I turn on all the water layers, making sure I understand where springs and guzzlers are, where there's creek beds. I'm looking at access points, roadways, you name it. They have it for planning an awesome hunt. I'm storing all of that information in a single hunt plan so I can keep all of my information organized and there's not a bunch of icons on my screen every time I open up my app. There's a reason why I've used Go Hunt Insider to do my e-scouting and plan every single Western hunt I've ever gone on. And it's because it is truly the best resource for the Western hunter. Head over to GoHunt.com and check out all the tools and resources you get with your Insider membership, and you'll see why it's my favorite tool for punching tags. And the best part is, when you use the code WESTERN, they're going to give you $50. That's right, they're going to give you a $50 credit to the gear shop that has some of the best hunting and backpacking gear on the market. So no matter if you're a brand new hunter or a Western veteran, I promise you there's something in the gear shop that'll catch your eye. Head over to GoHunt.com, check it out. Don't forget to use the code WESTERN and start getting your e-scouting plans together because it's going to be hunting season before you know it.
The IKEA effect?
I haven't, but I'm wondering if it's like you feel better about it because you built it.
Yeah, so there was a study done by, I think it was Harvard, the study done where they had two different groups. One group was just given an IKEA dresser, and then they gave it, you know, like, rate this dresser. How do you feel about it? And then the other group, you have to build the dresser. How do you feel about it? And by and large, the group that built the dresser had a much higher rating than the group that just was given the dresser, to prove the point that the more time and energy or work you put into something, the more you value and appreciate it. And it's something that I talk about quite a bit because I think it applies in so many aspects of our life, but it makes total sense why hunters in particular have so much gratitude and appreciation for their wild games, because we worked really hard to get out there and get it. And the harder the hunt is, the more grueling and shitty the weather is, the more rewarding and gratifying it becomes. And then you've got a story to tell at the dinner table. And so I like to talk about that a lot because I encourage people who've never – they may never go hunting a day in their life, but if they take – a small amount of time to get outside and find where their food comes from, whether they're going to a farmer, learning how that farmer raises their animals, about their dispatch processing, anything that you do, the more you put into it, the more you get back out of it. And to me, that is something that no amount of 5-star Michelin chefs can replicate if you can't have that feeling you get when you sit down to eat. If you don't get that appreciation, like, it doesn't really matter how great the food is. So that's one thing I like talking about a lot.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you were to, like, explain the opposite to a hunter, you'd be like, that's why a lot of us have no interest in doing a high fence hunt.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like when it's kind of canned and, you know, set up, you know, you come in on Friday afternoon and Saturday morning, it's all done. It's like, well, that's not, you know, you miss that step, the exact step you talked about. And then that's, you know, a huge part of why a lot of hunters and outdoorsmen aren't interested. Not to say it's wrong or right or whatever, but a lot of us just aren't interested in that style of hunting. We want to put in the work and then feel that, you know, the reward of all that, you know, kind of the fruits of the labor. And so I think it makes perfect sense. It just, I never really applied it to like other parts of, like you said, all the other food on my plate until like very recently when I started doing gardening and realizing it's a lot of work to keep the weeds out.
It's a lot of work because you go to the store, farmer's market, and you're like, ugh, why do I got to pay this much for this tomato? And then you grow it, and then you start having a tomato garden, and then you realize the squirrels and the hornworms and like everything else are eating it. You've got like one tomato left on the branch. You're like, okay, yeah, I'll pay a little extra for that. But yeah, I think, you know, in today's world, just in general, food waste is a huge, huge issue. And 40% of it happens within the home. And food waste isn't just wasting the food itself, but the resources that go into creating that food. And obviously, agriculture plays a huge role in how it impacts our wildlife. And so to me, it's like the more I can get people to understand the value and importance of food and not wasting things, I think just in general, the better off this world would be.
Yeah. I mean, so my day job is pretty closely tied to agriculture. And then I've also, you know, worked on dairy farms and done some research and just always, you know, generally interested. And so it, I don't know what the exact numbers are, and it changes, you know, location to location and what's, you know, variety of beef you grow. But generally, beef is like 30 to 40 pounds of feed to produce 1 pound of protein, right? And you know, like then they say like, well, rabbits are very efficient producers of protein because they, you know, they eat a lot less to produce a pound of protein. But imagine how the mindset would shift if every time a pound of hamburger spoiled and you threw it out, you were also like visibly throwing out 40 pounds of feed. I mean, you'd be like, wow, that was a lot. Yeah. That went into that, you know, 1 pound. We should probably try not to let it spoil next time.
Yeah. I think you could apply that to anything and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very important. So as you were maybe, so you started Wild and Whole, the brand, as like a creative outlet and a blog sharing recipes and the stories behind the ingredients. And then I'm assuming at some point that turned into a relationship with Meat Eater where you mentioned you were is it a culinary consultant or
a content creator?
Content creator. Okay. So
I've had different titles over the years.
Do you get to pick your own? I like places where they're just like, pick your own title. And you're like, oh, I'm
chief culinary expert. No, I don't. I think I don't know what's up with the titles. I think it depends on, I don't know. No, I started, so I met Steve about 6 or 7 years ago. Is that right? Yeah, I met him I was working at an event for Pheasant Fest, and he was speaking at it in South Dakota. And I had breakfast with him, Yanni, and Doug Duren. And they were talking about how, you know, Meat Eater was going to become a bigger and more evolved brand. And they asked me to join on, and I was like, absolutely. So I got to kind of join the company when it was just really a handful of people.
Yeah.
Big whiteboard with lots of ideas. Everyone was incredibly passionate about what we were doing. And, you know, we had sort of a foundation for the ethics and what was really important to Meat Eater as a brand and how we were going to grow. And so to hear several years later to see what we've become and, you know, acquiring First Light and all the other handful of brands, it's been really an amazing journey to be a part of it all. And I'm finally excited to contribute my own piece of the pie with this cookbook.
Yeah. That's awesome. And so that whole journey, I assume, you know, because you had the passion for cooking from the beginning. So when you, when the idea for the book really maybe took shape, and it maybe became more of not an if, but a when or a now, did you have those, like, those personal favorite recipes that you knew would be a part of the book? And then was there a bunch of recipes where you were, you know, finding and searching that period of time? I think you mentioned like 2 or 3 years that you've been, you know, actively working on the book. Yeah, kind of what did that look like?
I think by the time this book's out, I want to say it's close to 4 years of in the making from the time that, I mean, I had an idea that I like, I wanted to write a book, but I didn't know if it was feasible. And then I started getting some emails from publishers reaching out to me, and I was like, oh, maybe this is something I can actually do. And so then once I started working on a proposal from that point on, and then landing a cookbook deal with Penguin Random House, I spent about a year and a half or so just working on the recipes. And there's definitely a few of them that are just tried and true favorites over the years that I make over and over again. Like one of them, I call it homesick enchiladas. I'm born and raised in Texas, spent a long time in North Dakota, and I was really homesick for Tex-Mex foods. And so that, like, that recipe is kind of just one of those staples that I've grown up with my whole life, that I love. So there's definitely a handful of those, but throughout the process, what I knew I wanted to do with this book that was different, you know, was stay true to the Wild and Whole brand and incorporate not just wild game, but everything else on your plate. And more importantly, to do it in the way that reflects my actual lifestyle. So the way that I live throughout each year. And so the book is organized throughout the seasons instead of by protein. So I think most wild game books you'll find, you know, a chapter on venison, a chapter on turkey or whatever, waterfowl. So I decided not to do that. And I decided to focus on the season because I want people to feel really inspired to get outside and get really excited about what's happening at any given point throughout the year. So if you think about spring, I mean, the first thing that comes to your mind is probably turkey. And what else is happening in the spring? You know, it's like all the things that come to life. If you're, you know, up in the northeast, is it tapping maple trees? Right. You know, if you're in Texas, the spring rains push all the hogs out into the, out of the ravines and onto the pastures. And like, we always shoot a ton of hogs in spring. And so it's just, it's, there's just different little things in different parts of the U.S. And then obviously, you know, summer, I do a lot of fishing. Fall, I mean, oh gosh, like fall is such a big time of the year. There's so many things happening. So I wanted people to just get excited about getting outside and sort of having an adventure to get their food.
Yeah, I like the format. Obviously I didn't know about it until you shared with me, but you're very right. Like I have I think the original Meat Eater cookbook sits on our countertop. We kind of always pick one cookbook to like stay on the countertop as a almost more of decor than anything else. And I think it's either the Yellowstone cookbook right now or the Bean Eater cookbook, but I'm a very big sucker for a cookbook. Like if I see one and I have like any amount of connection, I have to buy it. Like I just have to. And we were doing like a quick errand. Like I think it was a return at Target on the way to like a family event. And I saw the Yellowstone cookbook on a easel. I'm like, babe, we have to buy that. And she's like, we don't even cook those foods. I'm like, I don't care. It looks cool. And so we got that. But yeah, the original Meat Eater cookbook and the Yellowstone cookbook are both, it's either, it seems like organized by entree, like, you know, appetizer, entree, dessert, or like in the case of the Meat Eater one, it kind of breaks down small game, big game, waterfowl, upland, you know, fish, how to butcher it. And then, but this I like because it's more of a story almost, like, and it matches the story of life, like how it is. We cycle through the seasons too.
Yeah. And it's really more so an invitation to get outside and explore, things you may not have thought about eating before, whether you're new to foraging, new to gardening. To me, I like to say a celebration of a diversity of ingredients because you're going to find a recipe with tongue in it. You're going to find rabbit. I love cottontail rabbits. And then you're going to find other ingredients that you may never have thought to work with. Porcini mushrooms, stuff like that. A lot of vegetables, very, very veggie heavy, and meat, and
yeah,
a little of everything.
That's awesome. I have a question for you. I hope it doesn't turn into a hot take, but so our farm, I have a berry patch, but right where I planted the berry patch was like overgrown, I believe, with wild raspberries. So would the difference be that gardening is when I pick a raspberry off the one I planted in a row, and then foraging would be where I walk 10 feet over and pick one off the wild plant? Like, where's the line here?
I would be foraging. Yeah. You didn't grow it. If it's native, it's foraging.
So then I would also be foraging for the rhubarb, because I didn't plant that either, but we have rhubarb on the farm.
Does rhubarb grow wild? I'm like not familiar with like these rhubarb. Midwestern, is just such a Midwestern thing.
No, I think, well, it does. I don't know. Like, rhubarb's kind of this like unknown, because you can't really buy it very often. I believe the leaves are toxic to humans.
Yeah, I've tried growing it in Texas, and it's just too damn hot. Way too hot.
I think you need a lot of water. Yeah, you probably need a lot of water. We have a lot now, so we're making rhubarb stuff, but we're trying to be conscious about how much sugar we put into it.
I can imagine that's.
And I'm like, hey, we should do this with honey, and I had no idea. My wife really likes local honey, and I'm like, oh, perfect. And we don't have to buy sugar; it's cleaner. She's like, that's a lot of honey, and I'm like, okay. And she's like, well, that's like very, very expensive. Like, that's going to be a $30 jar of rhubarb. And I'm like, oh, maybe not.
Yeah,
that's pretty funny. Got to figure out something else. But no, I've never been a big forager. I think I found a morel mushroom one time, but I wasn't sure if it was the morel or the one that looks like a morel but isn't consumable. And so I left it where it was.
Well, that's a safe bet.
I've heard that you might be better to ask this question, but I just recently heard an interesting mushroom statistic that it was like 95% of all mushrooms are – you can eat, like, of the varieties, like most varieties of mushrooms you can eat, but there's some that will really mess you up, and those ones are a little bit more common than a lot of the other ones. And so it's like,
no, I don't know if I believe that.
Okay, not good info.
No, what I have learned through foraging is most are not edible. There's a handful of mushrooms that are easy to identify. Morels, chanterelles, oysters, boletes. But when you start to dabble in the world of guild mushrooms, then you can be gambling a little bit. You really have to know what you're looking for. And you have, that's something that I personally like to shy away from. But yeah, if you're getting into foraging and especially mushrooms, obviously identification is pretty crucial. And so having books, ton of research online, and then like actually finding somebody in your area.
Summer is finally here, which means hunting season is also going to be here before we know it. So now is the perfect time to be trimming lanes, planting food plots, and putting up some new stands so you're ready when those big bucks start cruising this fall. And if you've been thinking about putting up a new stand on your property, I can tell you it has never been easier with the combination of Maverick Hunting Blinds and their all-new Elevate platforms. I've got both on my property, and one of my favorite things about the Booner panel blind and the Elevate platform is how easy it is to set them up. Building a deer stand used to be a multiple weekend project for me before, but now with this Booner panel blind and Elevate platform, I can have a new stand up in just one day. I can even get these into every part of my property because they're super light and easy to assemble, yet rock solid when you're on top of that platform. Make sure you roll into this fall confident and ready for those big bucks, because you know you got your stand set up and ready to rock well before season even started. Head over to maverickhunting.com to check out all the options and see why I'm such a huge fan of hunting out of these Maverick platform blinds. And when you check out using the code WESTERNROOKIE, you're going to save 10% on your entire purchase.
locally that's a foraging expert and go on a foray is extremely helpful too, just to like ask a million questions and kind of give you that confidence to go home and cook it.
It's good to know. I think we probably would have some good mushroom habitat. From what I understand, mushrooms like moisture. I think they like decomposition processes, right? Like logs and stumps that are decomposing
I mean, it depends on the type of mushroom. Some things grow on dead or dying wood, and some things grow, have a symbiotic relationship with, the trees. So like the mycelium and the tree roots interconnect. I went on a truffle foraging adventure one year in the Pacific Northwest, and it was fascinating because truffles are, they never come up above the ground. They're below the ground, and they have this symbiotic relationship with the trees, and they help the trees, and the trees basically give the sugars and everything that the truffle needs to grow. And it's really a fascinating thing, but like a little known, important part of the ecosystem of the forest there that a lot of people don't know about. But anyway,
very interesting.
Yeah.
Truffles are like morels, right? Like very hard to replicate commercially, and which is why they're so valuable.
Yes. They're very difficult to cultivate and to grow. The place that I went to produced the first Perigord mushroom, truffle. But there are native truffles that you can forage that are wild, but most of the truffles that you've had, like truffle oil and any kind of truffle flavored anything, is synthetic. It's not real truffle. And so I didn't realize till I went foraging and had a real fresh shaved truffle how wildly different they are. Like night and day difference.
And I would assume the wild one's better, or else there would be no need to try to replicate it.
Yeah, the wild ones were interesting. I mean, I found two different ones. We found a white truffle, which was incredibly pungent. Like, I'm talking something, a truffle the size of a pea. I could smell it in the ground. Like, when you stuck your nose into the ground, I could smell it. It's so intense. Like, I would describe it as taking paint off the walls. It's so intense. And then there's the native black truffle there in Oregon that had like a pineapple-y cake batter fruity smell. Totally different. And what's really cool about truffles, and this is getting a little geeky into I'm a food nerd here, is it's VOCs, the aroma that it puts out and infuses into other foods, that makes a truffle really unique and special. Not necessarily eating it itself, but it's the aroma.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm not a huge like mushroom on their own person, but when they're mixed in intentionally and in a good way to dishes, man, does it really, like, it's, I've always kind of described certain things. It's like kind of like the barbershop quartet effect, where it's almost like there's a secret hidden flavor amongst the four ingredients, you know, but somehow together they create, you know, something more than each of those four could have done on their own.
Exactly. And a lot of that comes from the umami flavor from a mushroom that it gives, and it can make other foods taste more meaty. Like, that's why I love to pair it with venison, is because venison itself has its own robust flavor, and the mushrooms can enhance that and bring it out, not making it more powerful, but more meaty in a way. It's kind of hard to describe.
Like a deeper flavor. Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe I shouldn't talk like I know.
No, that's right.
But like, when you hear people with like describe wine as like, oh, it's a fuller, or it's got more body, or like there's just more depth. Yeah. But sometimes it's true. Like, some flavors are like just very top notey. I have a beard oil company, so I have like top notes and middle notes and base notes of like, you know, which scents last longer. It's like the top notes, usually the thing you smell first.
Mm-hmm.
And then the base notes, what is still lingering hours later.
Yeah.
And so some recipes, some foods just have a top note. Like that's all it is. Like what you first, and then other recipes like have like multiple layers of like flavor.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that we usually eat too much of. So very fun. One of the things we mentioned in the green screen that I wanted, I made a mental note because I wanted to come back to it. You mentioned that you also touch on the different cuts of wild game and better ways to utilize some of the cuts than maybe the traditional, you know, I'll throw myself out there. Growing up deer camp, we would butcher everything ourselves last day of the season. And for the most part, we cut out the steaks and we ground most of the rest. I mean, pretty much all of it. And every now and then someone would want a roast. So we'd cut a roast, but usually we cut the roasts based on where the biggest chunk of meat was with no regard to what muscle group or, you know, combination of muscle groups it was. It was usually the rear quarter where you can cut a big square roast out of, and that was the roast. And then we ground everything out. So I'll throw myself up for criticism, but that's what we've always done. And then growing up and doing more of it on our own, especially bow hunting where I get to really just butcher by myself, I've really taken a higher interest in understanding the muscle groups, mostly from an efficiency standpoint of butchering, but also like now trying to get into like what are better ways to utilize, you know, especially some of the cuts that maybe people go, you know, we're to this part, right? Like, I don't think anyone's worried about what to do with a backstrap or a tenderloin. They've got their favorite backstrap and tenderloin recipes, but the other cuts, very interesting to hear your thoughts on some of your favorite, maybe nuanced cuts.
Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting. Hunters, they have to wear a lot of hats. Not only are you going out and shooting this deer, but you got to break it down. You got to process it in the field. You got to go home and take care of it. Or maybe you do go to a meat processor. Either way, you got to wear a lot of hats before you actually get to cook it. And so I kept getting asked like pretty much what seems like the same question over and over is like, what do I do with this cut? What cut is what, and what do I do with it? Right. And I kind of got frustrated feeling like having to answer every single little one. And I wanted to find a way to demystify this a little bit. Because if you really think about it, there are only two ways of cooking. You can cook something that's very tender, hot and fast, and you can cook, or you can cook something that's really tough, low and slow.
Right.
And that's, I mean, there's obviously that's a very generalized way of looking at it. But from a very basic cooking standpoint, that's it. You got a tender steak, hot and fast, or you got a shank, you can cook it forever on a low temperature. So once you kind of organize it into like those two categories, then it's like, okay, if I can understand those muscle groups, then I can separate into those categories and know exactly what to do with it. And so I did kind of make a butcher chart that was very detailed at exactly which cut is which, because I think so many people just call a roast, which is so common. Like, I don't know how many butcher charts I've looked at that have called parts of the hindquarter roast. And it's like, what is a roast? Is it a noun? Is it a verb? What are you doing? Are you roasting the roast? What are you doing? I just filmed a cooking video for this exact scenario for the Meat Eater YouTube channel, which will also come out in October. So if you're listening to this and you're like, that's my, how do I roast my roast? That's literally the title of this cooking video coming out.
That's perfect. Because my description of a roast would have been by volume. If you can cut a chunk of meat that's 2 pounds, that's a roast. If it's only a 2x2, that's like stew meat. And if you can grind
is it just a big hunk of muscle? Or is it, I mean, a roast is also a cooking method. So like, what do you do with a roast? Well, the thing is, there are different roasts on an animal. Some are really tender and some are really tough. So I don't always cook it the same way. And I frankly, like if you're going to say I'm going to make pot roast, I don't think those those roasts with no silver skin on it are very good candidates for pot roasts, which I can go into detail later. So anyway, so that's kind of how that section is organized. Is I have a butcher chart and I say what's tough, what's tender. And okay. Then after that, I have a description of different cooking methods. What does low and slow mean? You know, that's obviously your crock pot recipes, your slow braised dishes. It could be things like smoking mm-hmm. meat on a smoker. It could be confit. And so I have it organized, like you can go to the resources in the back where you can find, be like, okay, I have this cut of meat. Okay, it's tough. So I'm gonna look for one of these cooking methods, and you can see all the recipes that'll fall under that cooking method. So basically you can say, okay, I have this roast. Here are all the recipes I can make with that roast. Just to kind of make it easier for people to sort of figure out what recipe to do instead of flipping through every page of the book, looking for a recipe, trying to figure out what to do with this cut of meat.
I got a bottom round. Where's the bottom round recipe? Yeah. I like that. I really do.
Well,
that
and that's really tough tools. Because that's not how, you know, most recipes are written, because I don't write recipes. Say I have a stew or a braised dish. I'm not saying bottom round roast, because you can use several different cut there. You can use the shank, you can use the neck, you can use the shoulder. So, I mean, I do try to list it so that you can see visually like, okay, I have that. I can use that, but there's multiple cuts of meat that you can use for all of those types of recipes.
Yeah. I like that because it gives the reader of the book tools. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a math and science guy. And like, once I learn a formula, I can apply that to a bunch of different problems. But if I don't have the formula, like I can only memorize so many math problems.
Right.
And so
it
like,
is very much a formula.
With recipes, it's like I could try to memorize all these recipes, or I could just understand how different cuts of meat should be cooked, and then I know how to apply like the right recipe to the right cut.
Right. And in that regard, like the formula for something that is tough is so simple.
Low and slow.
Low and slow. And I mean, you're browning, you know, the initial sear at the beginning that most recipes call for is simply to add flavor. It's creating a browning reaction to make it more, to make it richer and fuller in flavor. But if you're not cooking it, you know, you're just browning it. That's just a
Maillard
flavor
effect.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. That's what that's called. And so after that, it's just about adding the aromatics, your liquids, turning it down on low heat, and then just leave it alone. Let it do its thing. And it's incredibly easy. So that's the simple formula.
There's been two cuts of meat that have always, I mean, I don't know if it's been more captivating to me, or I'm just interested in them because it's not as straightforward. And maybe three, really, if I think about it. But like the backstraps and the tenderloins, I think a lot of people have their favorite recipes. You know, you'll talk to people, it's tradition when we're butchering, we like fry up the tenderloins while we're butchering and, you know, have snacks and, or we do this or whatever. Backstraps, I mean, big elk, I love cutting just steaks out of because I love steak, and elk are generally big enough to do that. For like whitetails, especially like a whitetail doe, I really love doing like a butterflied stuff backstrap, some version of that recipe, just because the medallions themselves probably aren't that as big, but a million things you can do with those. And the rear quarters, I think I've really gotten into like cutting apart the specific muscle groups instead of just like big hunks of meat at once. And then it really lets you kind of pick and choose, you know, this is what I'm going to use for a jerky because I want to do a little bit of jerky. And then this is what I'm just going to grind because I, you know, obviously we need our taco meat and our spaghetti sauce and all that stuff too. But then these other ones make great steaks as well. When it comes to the shanks, that's one you probably get a lot of questions on. What am I supposed to do with this? It takes forever to butcher and debone if I'm going to grind. And the neck roasts, or the neck meat, I would say, because that's like almost in my mind harder to, if you're going to butcher and cut away everything that's white. I mean, very difficult, especially on a, you know, a full rut elk or a deer where there's lots of
don't
different
even
connective
try
tissues. That's exactly, I mean, so I was going to ask you for what, like those two cuts, what are your go-to maybe methods or recipes?
So that's a great point. When I very first started hunting and butchering, I just took the advice that was given to me from my husband, who learned it from his dad. And his dad is, well, all you need to know is get the silver skin off. Okay. All right.
That's how I grew up. Yep.
And boy, did meat processing take forever. And it was like, I can't believe we're taking so much time to now that I have taken a lot of time to understand the science behind cooking, but more importantly, understanding what makes up muscle and connective tissue and how does that react during cooking and why is that so important? Once I began to understand that, I started doing a lot less work. So yeah. All of that silver skin and tissue, connective tissue, is made up of collagen. And the harder an animal works, the tougher its lifestyle, the more, the tougher that connective tissue becomes.
Right.
You know, think about the difference between a cow who's been grain fed its whole life in a small pasture versus an elk in the mountains. You're talking right. like totally different structure there. But all of that is just all that collagen is actually really valuable because what happens is collagen turns to gelatin. And
yep.
This is the stuff that people spend a lot of money to put in their coffee every morning or their smoothies every morning because it's that great amino acid profile, high protein. So, you know, the only way to make that useful to us in a consumption perspective is you have to break it down. And the only way to break it down is it has to reach a certain temperature, which is 180 degrees, and it has to be held at that temperature for an extended period of time. And eventually that connective tissue breaks down, dissolves into gelatin. And that's the stuff that if you've ever had a really good bone broth and you stick it in the refrigerator, take it out and it wiggles like jello, that's gelatin. That is gelatin you've converted from collagen. And wild game is absolutely loaded with the stuff. So most people look at that and say, oh my God, I don't want that. Get it out because it's so chewy and gross. But it has so much nutritional value. And in addition, when that does break down, it's what adds when it's hot. Served, you don't want to eat it cold because then you're like eating meat jello. When it's hot, it melts and you've got this very succulent kind of viscosity that you're adding to whatever braising liquid. If it's a super stew or a sauce, you're adding this viscosity to it that's thickening it up. And it sort of helps to mitigate the fat that wild game is so incredibly lean. There's right. not a lot of fat to it. So when you have all that excessive amount of collagen in that braising liquid, you're making up for that fat loss and it's going to taste juicier and silkier when you're going to eat it. So I will trim like a little bit of like just a little bit on the outside, especially if it's like dirty. Or if there's hair or any debris right. on it, I'll trim that stuff. But for the most part, like I keep a lot of it on.
Yeah.
I keep a lot of it on and I don't mess with it. And I don't waste time trimming all that when I'm processing meat. Because for one, whenever you go to freeze it, it's a great way to protect against frostbite.
Right.
That way, if you do leave it in the freezer way too long, you can take it out, trim that silver skin and the meat is relatively just fine underneath it. But really it's just save yourself the time. Don't try to hack all that off. Just cook it.
That is what I've been getting more and more into. And so a lot of the shanks, I don't trim those out anymore. We just cut them at the joint. And then I actually asked my mother-in-law for Christmas one year for the biggest turkey roaster she could find.
Yeah.
And she's like, are you sure you want a 30-quart turkey roaster? And I'm like, is that the biggest? Because I want, if they have a 38, I'd rather have that one. And she's like, that's ridiculous. But she got me a big one. And I'm like, I'm just going to batch process or, you know, cook the shanks, and I've been cooking them down, and I probably need a better, you know, medium or a liquid base. I could, there's probably room for improvement anyway, but just slow cooking them until they fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've been straining them, which maybe I shouldn't be doing. Maybe I should find a better use for all that gelatin, but, and basically just making like shredded barbecue meat, shredded taco meat, just, I mean, so much easier too when you're butchering to just.
So much easier.
Yeah.
A lot less work. You can get a bone saw or a reciprocating saw and cut it up if you want to make osso buco, because then you get to get the fat out of the marrow on the inside of the bones. Sometimes life happens. You get busy. Just throw it in whatever pot it can fit in. One thing that I love to do is I'll brine them in like just a salt, sugar, water solution. Usually about a quarter cup of salt to 4 cups of water, and make enough to submerge like a couple of shanks in there for like a day or two, rinse it off, dry it really well. And then I'll smoke it for like only an hour or two just to infuse it with smoke. And then I'll throw it in a pot with and make stew. So you get like this really nice smoked stew out of it. And then the meat can shred apart the way you want.
That sounds really good. I'm going to have to try that the next time. But yeah, I've been, even on like a front shoulder of a, like a, especially like a, I try to harvest a lot of white-tailed does because I love the meat and we have too many of them on the farm. And when I do it right, a lot of times I'll take the whole front shoulder from blade to shank and I'll tie it with butcher's twine so it like freezes in the right size. And I'll do that slow and slow on the whole front leg, because even on like a white-tailed doe, like the flat iron and the arm, like there's, it's still like, there's not a lot there to be trimming out for a grind. And I feel like I started doing this because I felt like it was so wasteful to try to trim those cuts. And because you're like, I was just seeing how much, you know, red ends up in the throw pile. Yeah. And I'm like, there's gotta be a better way. I feel like I'm wasting like 50% of this.
You definitely get that way. I try to give a lot of that to my dogs, honestly. Because even though I don't trim a lot of it, there's always something to trim. There's always trim. But I'll give a lot of trim to my dogs. But yeah, sometimes the answer is just less work.
Less work. Well, especially when you have a lot. I mean, I think one year we butchered 8 deer in one day. So then it's... You're starting to get into an efficiency mindset. Really fast.
Yeah.
And some of those are the best way to just, like you said, we've been taking a Salazar right at the joint and done. I mean, you got to rub it off, wash it off with some of the bone, but super fast, super simple, you know. And so we've really been liking that. And it's been going well. I just want to keep getting better at it. And I just feel like, I don't know. I think cooking is one of those things where there's always something new to try and experiment with and build upon. And I'm not a cook to begin with. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for me to get better at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's always something to explore and more to learn. Even I've been doing this for a long time and there's always something that I'm learning. And I think it's an evolution of whatever's happening in my particular life. Like right now I'm pregnant, getting ready to have a baby. I'm probably not doing a lot of the fancier recipes. I shouldn't even say fancy, because I wouldn't say anything's fancy, but something that takes more time to cook. Really starting to backtrack and kind of figure out how I can simplify some of those recipes that I know and love. Just because I'm about to have a newborn and life's going to be a little crazy.
Definitely understandable.
So I'm excited to like enter this new territory. It's like a different cooking phase for me.
Yeah. And then I'm assuming, you know, I don't know when it is, 12 months, 18 months down the road when little ones start transitioning from baby food into solid foods and, you know, adult foods. I have a nephew that's, we just got his 2-year anniversary, his 2-year birthday party, invite. And so, I mean, obviously we're invited, but you know, in this last 12 months, he's really been experimenting with a lot of, you know, solid foods and adult foods. And I'm sure that'll be a new portion as well of like trying to figure out what your family likes to eat, because kids are pretty picky sometimes.
Oh God, that's my biggest fear. I just want him to be a good eater. I've talked to so many people about it. Like, what's the trick here? You know, like, I only want to cook one meal, and I do not want to buy frozen nuggets. Yeah. If he wants to eat fried chicken nuggets, like, I'll go get chicken and we'll fry it up. Like, because if I'm going to eat the same meal, like, I'm going to eat it the way that I want to eat it. I like a good fried chicken too. I get you, kid, but I don't want to eat fried dinosaur shaped chicken nuggets.
Dino nuggies, yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Or one mac meal, and cheese every night.
We're all eating one meal. But it's been challenging because I've heard from so many other mothers that, like, every kid is different, and no matter, like, how your mind is set, you just can't always control it because there's a lot of other environmental things that happen. They're going to go to school and have friends and learn to eat other foods. And I'm going to, you know, asking for Chick-fil-A every single day.
I'm the last person to give advice because we don't have any kids, but I do feel like a big, like, portion of it is, like, are the parents or are the, like, the people that you spend the most time with picky eaters, right? Like, if mom and dad are super picky and don't, like, I feel like those are behaviors that children will pick up on, like, very easily.
I'd like to think that's the case, but I also know that there's other things beyond my control. It'll be an experiment for sure.
I'm very excited to see how that goes. And I'm sure we'll be there at one day too, trying to convince our kids that, you know, shanks are really good. And like, yeah, no, it looks gross. It's like, well, some things don't look the way they taste.
My
parents were, I think my parents were from a different generation where if I didn't like what was for dinner, it went in the fridge, and when I was hungry later, that was my option.
That's kind of how I grew up. I don't ever remember having, like, a different meal ever. It was like, that was it.
Yeah, and eventually, I guess I just learned that there's no sense fighting because this is what it is.
Yeah.
If I'm asked, I get to choose, but usually I wasn't asked. It was just, this is what's for dinner, and it was usually about efficiency because both my parents worked a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I don't want this. All right, well, you'll want it later when you're hungry, I bet. That's what. Yeah. And they were right. Most of the time I got hungry and then I ate it.
Yep.
So
that's funny.
No, it'll be very interesting. One of the things that popped into my mind while we're talking about all these different things to do, which cut of a wild game, and it can be any fur, fin, feather, whatever, are you most excited for when you go out and you harvest that animal? I mean, maybe it's just because there's a recipe you really like with that meat, or just it's always been your favorite, but what makes you most excited, like, to cook this part?
I get that question all the time, and the answer changes all the time because it depends on what I have a lot of and what I don't have a lot of.
Okay.
The first year I decided we were going to just hunt for all of our protein, we did not shoot a deer. And we spent an entire year eating pheasants, ducks, geese, rabbits, and that was it. And we were eating ducks and geese, like, at least 3 times a week, at least.
So you've probably stumbled across some really good recipes to use them.
Yeah,
because those are some trickier animals.
North Dakota days, man, we had a giant enclosed trailer full of decoys that we drive out and sleep out and set the decoys out at nighttime, sleep in the trailer overnight and in freezing ass weather. And I'd shoot a bunch of geese, come home and have, like, snow geese, just 60 of them in the garage to clean. I mean, it was exhausting. It was exhausting.
I've been in those exact same shoes in those same fields in North Dakota. And it's like the best and worst thing about a good day of goose hunting is that you've got a lot of geese.
It's so exhausting. And that's really, like, goose was our primary red meat. It was either going to be a steak, a stew, or, like, we would grind it up. Like, I did so many different things with it. And then when we moved to Texas, we did a lot less waterfowl hunting just because we didn't have as many farmers around here are not as generous as they are in North Dakota about letting you hunt on their land. And then we were like getting to the point where we were like paying money for a hunting guide using our own decoys. And we're like, this is ridiculous. Like, no, I want to set my own decoys up and hunt the field the way I want. Like, this is, what are we doing? I don't need you as a guide. I just need hunting permission. And so it kind of got ridiculous. And so we hunted waterfowl quite a bit less. We still go to the coast and do coastal waterfowl hunting, but man, I don't get a good fat mallard very often. And so like back when I was eating nothing but ducks and geese, I was like, oh God, I never want to eat a duck again. And then now I'm like, I love a good fat, plucked, crispy skin duck breast, man. I love it. The answer to your question is it always changes. Like, what do I want the most? Cause you know, back then I would be like, I'd give anything for antelope or something like that or hog meat. And now I'm in Texas. I eat a lot of hog meat. And I'm like, I eat a little. So it's just, you know, you go through these phases where we just eat a lot of a certain type of animal.
Hey, I feel that. We've really been liking like a real good, I think we did either pumpkin or squash, ravioli, pheasant, pasta dish.
That sounds great.
We stumbled across on a shed hunt. We were staying at a lodge just for basically for the room, and because it was the same as the hotel, but they give you breakfast and lunch and have all the private land in the world to shed hunt. So we're like, oh, this makes perfect sense. And they were feeding like, it was a pheasant lodge in the fall. That was their main thing. And so they had tons of pheasant. So everything was like, pheasant white chili or pheasant and that recipe, we're like, we need to start making this. And so that's been, we don't shoot a lot of pheasants anymore because we bought a deer hunting farm. So that's been one. I kind of feel that like kind of whatever you haven't had in a while is usually the one you're most excited for next.
Yeah, man. We used to shoot a lot of cottontails in North Dakota, a lot of pheasants, a lot of cottontails, and it's a lot harder to get white meat, bird meat down here. But I get a lot of doves. I shoot a lot of doves now.
But it takes a lot of doves to replace a pheasant.
But it sure is fun shooting that many doves.
Yeah. No, it's worth it.
You go
through
a whole box of ammo to get that amount of meat.
Do wild hogs have like meaningful bacon cuts?
They can. It depends on the time of the year. And generally, it's going to be a sow, a big sow. Either getting pregnant or just had a litter or something. Generally those sows, especially if it's in kind of a foresty area with acorns in the fall, that is
higher fat content,
the best.
Yeah.
But I've had them in the spring. So my husband's family has a small ranch, and every spring the heavy rains, there's a big ravine running through the property, and the heavy rains flood the Brazo River, and then they kind of come up into the ravines, and like the hogs are just like everywhere. It's just like clockwork. And they just tear up all the pastures. And so we built a giant sea trap, because they're really difficult to hunt, especially in the daytime. And we didn't want to buy a night vision scope. And so we built a sea trap. And so we trapped a whole bunch of hogs. And one year we got a really nice fatty sow, and I was able to smoke and make bacon with it. And it was delicious.
It was the best bacon I've ever had. Of a recipe to do like a complete, like field to table. You couldn't really forage the jalapeno. You might have to, you might not even want a jalapeno, but like a dove bacon wrapped popper. Like jalapeno popper, but do it with like wild hog bacon and dove and then pepper from your garden, and like the whole process that'd be very fun, because that's obviously a fan favorite of any bird. If you want to make it taste good, just wrap it in bacon.
That bacon, I saved it all for BLTs in the summer.
Oh man, that would be good, especially from your garden. I mean,
it was, yeah, there's really.
And I know you said you weren't a huge fan of baking bread, but man, if you paired that with like the homemade bread or sourdough,
yeah,
wow, that would be quite the recipe. Mm-hmm. Is there I know we're coming up on time, and you're a busy person as well. Is there a recipe in the book that you would say that you're like, when you get the book, go to this one? Like, I'm really excited for you to try this recipe.
Let me pull up my table of contents on my.
There's a lot of them. So it's, you know, and they're all great. I mean, I'm not saying any of them aren't great. Just which one would you say?
On what season? But if, okay, here's a better way to answer this. If you ask my husband that question, because he loves all the things, he loves everything I cook, but sometimes he gets upset because like my job is to develop recipes and he's like, we're always eating something kind of new. He's like, sometimes like you'll make something that I really love and I'm like, I want to eat that again. Like, yeah. Like stop making new things. Let's like eat some of the old things that I really like. And so one of the things that he always requests for his birthday, which is in October, and it always works out great if we have a successful archery season, to do venison tartare. Mm. So it's raw preparation. If you're an adventurous eater, I have a recipe for venison tartare that's kind of like a take on the classic steakhouse version, but I do things where it's like just a little bit more textural and a little less mushy, I would say. And I don't do the raw egg yolk. I'll do like jammy eggs instead. So, and put it on a toast.
Ooh.
That would be his favorite easily.
Awesome. Well, that's a perfect way to answer the question. And I think it's a perfect way to wrap up the podcast. I appreciate you being here, Danielle. Give folks a chance to follow along. Where can they find you on different platforms and follow your adventures and your whatever works you're working on next?
Yeah. So I'm on social media just under my name, Danielle Pruett, and that's Pruett. I inherited that from my husband. So it's always funny because every time I ask somebody, you know, when you're like doing business or work, they're like, Pruett, and they're like Pruitt, and they're like, no, it's anyway. And if you want to find a recipe, all my recipes can be found on themeateater.com.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, we'll put links to both of those in the show notes, as well as links to your book, Wild and Whole. Go check it out today. Yep. And yeah. Excited. I'm excited for it as well. I'm actually probably going to have it pre-ordered by the time folks listen to this. But yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, thank you for being here and thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.